It has, okay, okay.
How long is it?
Yeah, it's like a mile.
I feel like mentally down.
Well, I just wanted to say, I think Frederick or someone else may have mentioned you before, but a lot of the stuff here is what you get at university, maybe the first or second year university. And so we really wanted to do that just because, I mean, I went through like every one of your applications, and so I was involved with the people that had chosen. And like I said, we only took really enthusiastic people and really bright people. And one of the things we want to do is really to challenge you and stretch, so it's like kind of like a physics team, so to speak. And but having said that, I think it can be fun. It can be fun to be challenged. But having said that, don't feel like you have to absolutely understand everything. And there won't be an exam at the end. And if you don't pass that, then you don't get your flight home. So if you don't understand anything, that's normal in physics. And you know, talk to anyone here, even all the research people here. And definitely, I've experienced this a lot of the time. I've gone to physics seminars, and walked out, especially in string theory. I've been to one seminar in superstring theory in my life, and the first page, first slide, I understood it completely. Second slide, no idea whatsoever. So it could have been a different language. And this is something experienced, but I think the most important thing is how you respond to that, what you think of that, and maybe just think, well, I don't understand this, but I'll give it a go and I'll try. But even if you don't get in everything, then it doesn't matter, and it's the same case, it's the way with everyone. And physics is hard. You talk to anyone around here, even the smartest people, it's hard. And for example, in the book, Einstein's Cosmos, like Einstein, I think some people think of this idea of Einstein, other people, they just, like, oh, just we're just walking down the street one day, and oh, we've got this idea for general relativity, it just popped into his head. If you read the book, it was a 10-year-long struggle. He was tearing his hair out. It was just really difficult. And there was one period where he actually, for about, I think it was around about 1912, 1930, he made a mistake. We just went down the wrong path for about 2 years. So can you imagine getting on one homework problem and thinking of the wrong way of doing it and working for 2 years trying to get it and then realizing that you found the right way of doing it. So that's kind of what it was like. But the important thing was he was very persevering. And he kind of stuck with it. And I think one of the main reasons he was just incredibly passionate about physics. He just loved his physics, just finding out about the world. So we'll give you a bit more math today. And then we're getting onto the physics proper. So we'll get on to quantum mechanics. But as I said before, this complex numbers and imaginary numbers will just be very, very useful in lots and lots of different areas of physics. Some of you will have heard of them before, some of you will know all about them, some of you won't. So we'll go over them. Have a look. So we'll just start out with trigonometric functions, so sine and cos. So we all know what they look like. We've got a graph there, kind of the standard sort of sine, wavy way, and so starting out at 0, then going up to 1 at 2 pi over 2, then down to 0 again at pi, and then sort of going down and repeating. So again, you get sort of sine and cos from the vertical and horizontal distances of when we draw, I guess, a circle of radius 1, and then draw a line to any particular point. So we've got some angle that line makes, I guess, with the horizontal axis, positive x-axis, and then just the horizontal vertical distances are cos and sine, respectively. So again, so you kind of may have to turn your heads on this side. We've got the cos graph there. Cosine graph starting at 1 there. So, okay. That's cos and sine. So, one of the things I think is in one of Frederick's questions is there are actually, again, series are useful, very sort of series or sums of various functions are just incredibly useful. And they're actually sums or series for sine and cosine. And that's actually the one for cosine up there. And so it's 1 minus pi squared, or theta, or theta, theta squared, divided by 2, plus theta to the 4th tau, divided by 1 over 24, and blah, 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 blah. And so you can actually get an explicit expression for that in terms of a sum. So, where is it? So, yeah. And so while we have the 2, 24, 7, 20, they're actually just the power. You have up the top the exponent and the factorial of that. So that's 2 factorial, 4 factorial, 6 factorial. And we want. So notice we so we just got all that's an explicit representation in terms of the sum that's to the infinity sign there. So we skip out all the odd powers, just have the even powers. And so we can kind of maybe just have a look that if we know that cos pi over 2 is 0, and let's look at how the series representation approximates that and gets better and better and better. So if we just take the first term, the approximation is 1. So 1 is a very bad approximation to 0, so we need to take some more terms. Take the first term, the theta squared term, we actually get 1 minus 1/2 pi divided by 2 squared, and that comes out to be minus 2.337. So minus 2.337, it's getting a better approximation, but even the first significant digit, it's not good. So if we take the next term, and even the next one after that, we sort of add a little bit to get the number up, we get plus 0.0199 and so forth, so we're getting closer. And then, so where we're converging? We're converging reasonably quickly on the correct answer. And by the third term, we're fairly close. We're just a little bit below you can see. And so you can continue this process forever, converging, just getting closer and closer to finding out to getting zero, and more accuracy with each term. And the interesting thing is, if we have, maybe if theta or theta is very, very small, then if you square a small number, square 0.01, you get that's 10 to the minus 4. So if we have a small number there, a very, very small angle, then we find out all the larger terms, the 6th power, the 8th power, the 10th power, and so forth, they're very, very small, because we're just squaring or taking some very small number to a higher and higher power. And so as a result, what we find is we can just basically ignore those. They're negligible. So we have this approximation here for a very, very small theta. And that can be very useful. We actually have the approximation cos theta equals 1 minus the 1/2 of theta squared. So that's cosine. We also have a power series expression for sine. And cosine had all the odd terms. You're adding up all the odd powers of theta. What we have for sine is we add up all the even powers. And again, we have on the bottom the denominator. What might be what, just in case you're wondering why we have the numbers 6, 120, 5,040. They're actually the factorial of the exponent. So 6 is 3 factorial, 120 is 5 factorial, and so forth. So just writing it more compactly, we have. Okay, we get this expression here. Now, I found in my career as a physicist that these are incredibly, incredibly useful to know and to remember. And that I've come to remember them just because I've used them so often. They're very useful because, I mean, trig functions turn up everywhere. Okay, so that's the explicit expression. And again, we can see an example of we have, I guess, the solid line there is the sine curve, sine wave, and what we have is the dotted lines where we include successively more and more terms. So the first one, which includes the theta, and that's just obviously a straight line, like y equals x goes up, and it's okay for very, very small values of theta, but it doesn't go so well as we deviate from zero. We look at a graph, I guess that's a quintic graph. We've got the theta minus 1/6 theta to the third divided plus 120 theta to the fifth. That is, yep.
I just have a question about your extension of Fischler's small theta. When you have j plus 1, wouldn't that give the wrong order for the negatives? Wouldn't it start negative theta plus 1/6?
Sorry, the...
On the blackboard there, with j plus 1 over 2. With j equals 1, that would be 2 over 2, and negative 1 to the 1 would give negative 1, which would be negative theta as the first term.
Oh, okay, so maybe it should be...
Minus 1 over 2.
Oh, okay. Yep, thanks for that. Okay. Thank you. Yep, that looks right. So, yep, thank you for that. Okay, where was I? Okay, so... And so, as I said, so for just as we get a good approximation, just taking the first couple of terms for... Or first couple of terms of the expansion for small values of theta for cosine, for small values of theta, we get a good approximation just taking the first couple of terms of that power series expansion. So just looking at, so for small values, actually for very small values, sine theta is approximately equal to theta. And so that's a very, very useful term or approximation to know. So we saw yesterday we actually can have a power series expansion for e to the x, the exponential of x. And that actually is what we had before. So that's just including both odd and even terms. Just to remind you. Given by that. There. And so we've got all the terms put out there. And so again, we can see that with the dotted line, as you take successively more and more terms, higher and higher orders, we actually get closer and closer to e to the x. So again, very useful approximations. Now we'll actually use them and put them in practice and look at complex numbers. So we've kind of introduced complex numbers graphically. Now I guess you'll know about Cartesian graphs, Cartesian coordinate systems. So just got a normal sort of x, y graph, sort of grid plot there. And what we can think of as a complex number as being a pair of numbers. So we've got some complex number, I guess, that would be probably meant to be the Greek letter psi. So we have psi equal just a comma b, and then parentheses around those. And so we can, I guess, just like any point or any coordinate in the Cartesian plane, we can label that by two coordinates, just the horizontal coordinate and the vertical coordinate. So we have the point up there in the first quadrant, 2 comma 3, and down the fourth quadrant, 2 comma minus 2. So again, that's something familiar. But what we can do with complex numbers is, I guess, instead of putting the labels on x and y, we can actually look at this, I guess, a complex space, and we can think of the horizontal axis as being the real axis, so we'll just call it the real axis for the moment, and the vertical one, the imaginary one. So these are just at the moment just labels, but we'll see what they mean. And so what we might do is label, I guess, every, introduce the symbol I, which I'll talk about in a minute, and actually put in front of any term or any number that actually is in the vertical direction, the vertical axis. We'll just denote that it is in the vertical direction by putting this I, kind of just at the moment, a symbol to denote it. So if we're sort of two across horizontally, that's two, but we want to go three upwards, so, well, that's what we've defined as sort of the I direction or the I dimension. And so we have 2 plus I, 3, or 3I, if you like. So just the I at the moment is just denoting with the vertical dimension or vertical direction that we're going sort of upwards there, up 3 units. And so we kind of get this idea, just as we had sort of two numbers, two coordinates, 2 comma 3, what we do have now, I guess, every number here, we can represent it just by two numbers summed together, some real number, and then this kind of weird I multiplied by, again, some other real number. So this point is sort of the 2 plus I 3. So at the moment, it's just a different way of representing points, any point you want in this two-dimensional space, this Cartesian space. And so if we have these numbers, we can think of them as complex numbers, that's the term, and again, it's just a label at the moment, but I'll talk a bit more about what they mean. What we do is we can add any two complex numbers together. So if we get a plus ib, where the a and b could be anything, any value, and C and D, again, C and D, they're just arbitrary, I guess, arbitrary numbers at the moment, arbitrary real numbers. And so what we do is to actually get the final value or the resultant sum is we just add, I guess, the horizontal components or the horizontal elements, that's A and C together, and we just add B and D together, so the imaginary components or the vertical components. And so that gives us, we just group the terms here differently, and A plus C plus I multiplied by B plus D. And these are exactly the same rules we use for added vectors. So you can think of A plus IB as, in a sense, as being a two-dimensional vector with an X and a Y component, and think of C plus ID as being a two-dimensional vector with an X and a Y component. And just as you add vectors together, the horizontal component to get a total horizontal component, and then a vertical component to get the total vertical component, then what you find out is kind of like a resultant vector. So it's kind of like adding vectors sort of top to tail together. So what do we have? Why do we have this idea of I? And really, often, so I guess most people, when they start off with numbers or doing math, you come across integers, just whole numbers, 1, 2, 3, and then you can generalize that. You can think, well, the numbers don't have to be whole numbers. You can actually have real numbers, if you like. So real numbers have numbers, I guess, with decimal points, and digits after those. So 2.34, 4.715, pi, for example, they're all real numbers. So we kind of have this, so we can extend numbers from whole numbers to real numbers, real numbers with decimal points in them. And we can extend even further real numbers to imaginary numbers. So it's kind of generalizing, expanding our notion of what we mean by numbers. So what we all know that if you get a real number and you square, well, I guess, okay, sure. So what we define, I guess, I, what I was talking about. So I guess we're used to taking the square roots of, say, the number 2, or square root of the number 4 being 2. So square roots of positive numbers. So what if we want to take the square root of, say, minus 1? What does that equal? Well, it's kind of not, I think at first glance, not really clear what it equals, because what then you have to find some other number that you could square and you get back minus 1. And what number could you square and you get minus 1? It's only when you square a number you always get a positive number. Here we seem to be demanding a number that when you square it you get a negative number. So what we do is we basically say, well, let's just call it a symbol for the moment, I. So what we have is I being the square root of negative 1. So what actually is I? I mean, it's very hard to get sort of a tangible, sort of a solid feel for it, but you can think of it as being sort of, in a sense, just as we go from whole numbers or integers to real numbers, we sort of extend this concept even further and go to imaginary numbers. And so it's actually just very, very useful. And in nature you find, well, complex numbers is incredibly useful to model all kinds of things in physics, from electricity to atoms, and all whole bunch of things. So we kind of have, I guess, this idea of, so really that's again, that's the definition. So we're defining I, which is square root of minus 1, and you can also sort of think of it as in a geometric way, just going back to the last page. We can think of all the real numbers or the normal numbers on the horizontal axis, but in a sense, we can think we have this other dimension of numbers, and it's sort of the I dimension or the I direction, and that's sort of going vertically upwards. So again, that sort of fits in the concept of just expanding our idea of what a number is, our notion of a number. So it's kind of a bit weird, but so I guess just if this I is square root of minus 1, we square both sides of that, we have I squared equals minus 1. So that's what I guess follows on from the definition. So if we have this idea of a complex number and I, this weird property I, we might wonder if we have two complex numbers. So these, again, numbers with an imaginary component. We have a component element which is just the square root of minus 1 in there, whatever that really means at a physical level we have, say, two complex numbers, A plus IB and C plus ID. We might want to multiply them two, the two together. How do we do that? Well, we just multiply, just expand it out, and we get two, you get four terms there, and we get I multiplied by B times C plus I squared multiplied by D, BD, but we know that if I is the square root of minus 1, then I squared will be minus 1. So we actually get this rule here. So we actually get, I guess this line here is what I'm looking at. So AC minus BD plus I AD plus BC is what we get. So we're looking at some examples of that. So why is this useful? What's the point of doing this? And one reason is that what we find is it's useful to find, because remember we had this expansion of power series expansion of e to the x we've got up there in terms of 1 plus x plus an x squared term, an x cubed term, and so forth. Imagine we replace x by I theta. So now we have I theta in the exponent. What we define is that we get this expansion here. So just basically rub out the x everywhere and get I theta. And so what we find, we get lots of I squares, I cubes, and so forth. And we do know, well, we know I squared, that's equal to minus 1. So in the third term there, I guess, in this line here, we can replace that with minus 1. So that just gives a minus sign, which, we have there. And then, so we have the I cubed. We can break that down to I squared, multiplied by I. So if we get I squared, we can replace that with minus 1. It's equal to minus 1. So we get a minus sign there. And so in that case, we get to the third term, the cubic term, we get minus I theta cubed divided by 6. And similarly, if we get I to the power 4th, then that's I squared multiplied by I squared. I squared is minus 1, multiply minus 1 by minus 1, we get 1. And so what we're led to is that actually I to the power 4th is just 1, so we can get rid of that. And so on and so forth. So whenever we can replace, no matter what order, higher order of I we have by just I to one power and just one I, and then we get at most, and then we get maybe a minus sign in there at the most. So we can get rid of all the higher powers of I, and we're just left with terms that have no I in them, or just I to the power 1. And so what we do is they alternate, so we get this expression here. Let's collect them all together. Let's collect all the terms up that have no imaginary number in them, so just have a real component. And what we find is they're 1 minus theta squared divided by 2 plus theta to the 4th power divided by 24, and so on and so forth. And if you actually look, that may actually look kind of familiar. And also we do a similar thing for the sine theta terms, the terms that actually have an imaginary component in them. And if we do that, you might notice that we have these power series here, and just going back a page or two, then the second one looks exactly like the power series we've got for sine, and it turns out that it is that. And the one before that looks exactly like the power series we got for cosine. So up at the top of the page there. So it turns out that e to the I theta is actually the cosine theta plus I sine theta. And so this is an incredibly important, as it says there, incredibly important and incredibly useful, I guess, representation and decomposition of e to the I theta using complex numbers. So what will this allow us to do? I'll just go through and tell you what it will allow you to do. What it's really leading on to is we can think of is really looking at to getting, I guess, into polar coordinates. So the idea is that you can represent any point here, P, on the Cartesian diagram, Cartesian plane, by points x and y. So, or the coordinates x and y, but in terms of x, y coordinates, Cartesian coordinates. But also, there's another way of looking at it. Every point, no matter where it is on that plane, you can represent it by telling how far it is away from this origin O, the center point. So saying at some distance r away from that, and by telling what angle it is around from the positive x axis, so telling what angle theta it is. So you pick any point, imagine any point here, I can say, well, I can tell you where it is, I can exactly specify it uniquely by saying it's, well, we'll call that r dash distance away, and the angle around there, we'll call it theta dash. And so what r and theta combine to be is another coordinate system, alternate coordinate system. And they're actually called together polar coordinates. So just as any point, instead of representing it by x and y coordinates, we can represent it by r and theta coordinates. And they're called polar, or the system is called polar coordinate system. So this is what we're leading up to here. So we can just represent, we know that e to the I theta is a complex number we can represent by cos theta plus I sine theta. And we can represent that on a graph, a two-dimensional graph, as I talked about before. So we've got the real axis horizontally. So the coordinate for the horizontal direction is cosine theta, and the vertical one is sine theta. So that's actually the coordinate of the value. So it's cos theta across, sine theta up. So that's the point there. But also, we don't have to specify in terms of cos theta and sine theta. We can specify it in terms of r and theta. So in this case, what we have is we just have e to the I theta multiplied by 1. So in this case, the r, or the distance away from the origin, is 1. That's just because every point on the circle there, you can see the circle's of radius 1, so every point is just 1 distance away, 1 unit away. So the r coordinate, you can see from the second graph there, is just 1, for example. And the theta coordinate, well, that's given by the same angle theta that we have from the, that appears in sine theta and cosine theta, so that's just the angle around that we have from the, I guess, positive x axis, the direction. And so what that tells us is gives us another alternate way of representing a plus I being any real number we want to, and I guess e to the I theta is one example of that using this formula. So that was how you might represent e to the I theta, which is look at it from an alternative point of view in terms of polar coordinates, but any complex number we want. What I should mention is we can basically represent it as in terms of any complex number a plus ib. What we can do is that's a point, that's just a point in a two-dimensional space. And so just as we can represent any point here by polar coordinates, any point up there we can represent by polar coordinates just by finding out what its radius is, the r value you have there, and then the angle theta, and finding out what... So these are just two different representations. Psi equals a plus ib plus r multiplied by I theta. They're two different representations. And one is, in different cases, some are more useful than others. And so just to finish up, well, actually, I should say we'll just have a short tutorial in the afternoon on complex numbers. So I'll give you kind of a short introduction now, and then you'll get to sort of play around and do problems with those and get to see about them. And then later on in the week, when we actually get to the real physics, undoubtedly, we'll be encountering complex numbers again and be using again. So it's very useful to know. And so I guess just one line, we can relate the radius. What's the radius for any number, any point, or any complex number in this plane here? Well, the radius, the horizontal component is a, and the vertical component is ib. So it's b units up in the I direction. And so just using Pythagoras, we want to find out r, which corresponds to the hypotenuse of a triangle, with side length A and other side length B, the sort of non-hypotenuse sides, the alternate and opposite sides. And so choosing Pythagoras, R equals the square root of A squared plus B squared, which is the length of this arrow here, or the length of this vector here. And that's, you can think of that sometimes denoted by, we put two arrows or two lines around psi, and that means it's just the magnitude or the size of that vector. So it's again the same concept as the magnitude of a vector. And what we end up with is a very sort of simple geometric interpretation for multiplying complex numbers. And so if we have two, we saw up here that the concept, to multiplying two complex numbers together, we multiply sort of all the real and imaginary components together and get something that looks like this line here. Well, if we actually represent we can represent, we don't have to use Cartesian coordinates, x and y coordinates, to represent any complex number. So we have these two complex numbers here. We can just switch over to represent them in terms of, I guess, the radius coordinate or the r radial coordinate or the r coordinate, and the theta coordinate or the angle coordinate, and their alpha and beta there. And what we do to find out what the result of modification is, all we do is modify a and b together. That's very simple. And then we need to combine the two exponents. And the rule is if you have two exponents, then you add the exponents. So okay, e to the a multiplied by e to the b equals e to the a plus b, like that. So what we do find is we just have added the exponents alpha and beta there. And so that's, again, the radial coordinates or polar coordinates, that's actually multiplied two complex numbers together. And so looking at that geometrically, what we find is we multiply the lengths together. So we have two complex numbers here, and the graph down the bottom, we want to multiply them together. We multiply the lengths to get this vector of sort of a much longer length typically, and we add the angles around. So we, I guess, add the two angles together, and we get this angle here, so alpha plus beta. So that's all we'll do on complex numbers for now, and imaginary numbers. So we don't need to do too much, just really to get you introduced to the idea and become familiar with that. So we'll have a tutorial later on, and we'll do some exercises. But now I'll just hopefully press the right button. Now we've got a bit of a change of pace. And Sonia, you...
Actually, usually smaller.
Okay, so you've all met. We'll be talking about action interactions and reactions.
Yeah, it's a bit more of a fun talk now, so this isn't going to be anything technical or anything like that. So.
That talk was fun.
Sure. Okay, so we're going to go a little more fun with this. Just, it's lighter. That's nice. Okay? Mm-hmm. So, who of you knows what you want to study in university? Absolutely know what you're going to study. Okay, so it's just a couple of you. How many of you want to study engineering? Or think you want to study engineering? Okay, so that's a good number. Computers of some sort. What about mathematics? Okay, mathematics. Wow. How about pure physics, though? What about that? Okay, so no one definitely had some double raised hands here. Okay, just to get a sense of what you want to do. I am, as I told you before, a second year student. So I'm going to be talking a bit about my experience and some things that I've seen. And I definitely want a lot of input from you guys, so this will be, you'll have to actually speak up in this one, all right? Okay, so the first thing we're going to start with, F equals MA. Anyone recognize this? Maybe? Just vaguely? Okay, good. That's good to tell you. Anyone know what it's from? Newton's second law, of course. It's part of Newton's laws. What's the math involved? What's one of the mathematical ideas you need to know to be able to understand this? Who thinks that's hard? Wow. What about the concepts or ideas? What are the key ideas and concepts that we have out of Newton's laws in general, and specifically the second law? Anyone? You guys can tell me the key ideas of Newton's laws. Come on. Inertia. Good. That's from the first law. What about this one? Anyone?
Proportionate to force.
There we go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the idea, right? And then, of course, third law. Yeah, we all had that built into our heads. Who thinks these concepts and ideas are difficult? Is force a difficult concept? Oh, we got one person here. You think it's hard?
I try to teach it all the time. I know it's hard.
Yeah. But is a force something that you can kind of see? I mean, do you guys see forces? Yeah. What about acceleration, mass?
Yeah.
Are these tangible? You can can relate to something you understand.
Yeah. There's something you can understand. It's also tangible, right? Like, we can see it, we can feel it, we can feel a force.
We can be in a car and here. We can understand where it's...
Yeah. That you could explain this to someone on the street, or that someone on the street would recognize it.
Yeah.
Layperson, yeah, pretty much. Okay. Who recognizes this one? Yeah. Good, good, we're getting somewhere, all right. What's this from? It is from my time, so I give it a lot. Okay. So what are the key ideas of special relativity and particularly this equation? Oh, sorry, again, math. Straightforward. You got one more. What about the concepts and ideas?
The mass is proportional to the amount of stored energy that it comes in.
Well, it's kind of mass energy equivalence, right?
Yeah.
Yes, we've got mass. That's the big one of this equation. What else out of special relativity?
That the laws of physics are the same in all inertial springs.
Yeah, that's a big one. What else?
Mass and energy are not necessarily conserved, but mass energy equivalence is.
Yeah.
The speed limit?
Yeah, there's another big one. Light is, the speed of light in a vacuum is the speed limit on how fast things can move. So that sounds like the key ideas? Again, do you think someone on the street would recognize this equation?
Yeah.
Pretty much. Do you think they could explain it and understand it?
No.
Do you think you could explain it to them so that they could understand
it? Yeah.
I mean, energy, mass, speed of light, they're still fairly tangible ideas, right?
No, they are.
Sorry?
A demo person would know energy gets.
Yeah, they have some concept of it. Energy gets a little more abstract, though, than acceleration or force, right? Mm-hmm. It's not as tangible, though we have an idea of it. Who recognizes this one? Anyone? Got a couple of hands? Who can tell who it's from? Schrodinger's equation, right? From quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
Okay. What's the math involved in this one? What else do we need?
I see an equal sign.
I applaud you for that one. Okay. Linear partial differential equation. Okay. What are the key ideas that we have out of this one? Out of quantum mechanics in the whole?
Yeah, the wave function.
The wave function, right? So we've got wave particle duality. What else? Other ideas out of?
The square of the wave function is proportional to the probability of finding an electron.
Right, so some of the probabilities that we start to see in fundamental nature, right?
Yeah.
What else? There's some other key things we learned.
There's a big one.
Everyone's familiar with the uncertainty principle? Yeah? What were you doing? Planck constant. Yeah, that was a really important physical constant that we got out of that. Any other ideas? There's one other really big one. Look at the name. Quantization, right? That's and we have things like spin, angular momentum, error.
Yeah.
Familiar with that? Okay. Someone on the street. Are they expressing that?
Thanks for having us.
No, they're probably not. Sure. Could you explain some of the concepts to them?
Yes.
What are some of the quantum mechanics? Can you explain and say
anything?
You
feel like a little bit confused.
Yeah. So you just start scaring people.
That's not the equation.
If you are really sure.
That's not the equation. You don't want to be on a laser valley, is that what you're saying? Fair enough. Okay. What about this one? Anyone recognize it?
Yeah, Einstein's equation from general relativity.
Einstein's equation from general relativity, indeed. Anyone wants to tell me the math involved in this one?
I forgot to
answer.
Terrifying.
Yeah, there's more than that. What else? This is actually, this one has 16 nonlinear hyperbolic partial differential equations. Try saying that 10 times fast. Sorry. It's a lot of difficult math.
Okay.
What we basically have, can anyone tell me the concepts of it? Some big concepts we got in a general relativity.
8 times 4.
5.
Matters.
Gravity. Yeah, gravity is just the way of warping space.
Space and time being equivalent.
There we go, that's another big one.
Yeah.
And the
Cosmological constant.
Cosmological constant, yeah. Another, again, you get the physical constants. Yeah. Sorry, what else? Oh yeah, we got a lot of ideas like that coming out of it too. Someone on the street.
No.
Do you think you'd get some of the concepts to them?
Yeah?
Like which ones? Black hole. Do you think they're gonna take it sort of a sci-fi sort of way? Kind of like Star Trek? Yeah. Okay, so this is getting even scarier now, right? Okay. Who recognizes this one? Anyone. Does anyone recognize it at all? This is known as...
It's all great to me.
This equation is known as the Wheeler-DeWitt equation or the Einstein-Schrodinger equation, and it is an attempt at quantum gravity. Okay. The physical verification of this one, I don't really know how that one's going. But this is basically what the attempts were to quantize gravity. Okay. Now, who thinks that looks scary? Anyone? Yeah, a little.
Is it just weird to say equals zero?
So for someone on the street, is this going to be scary?
Yeah.
And do you guys think you could explain it to them?
No.
Okay.
I don't
think anyone could explain it to me.
I just saw your eyes bulge right out of your head. That was great. So who knows what this is from? String theory, is that what you guys think?
Okay,
what else? Any other guesses?
We have
not
yet.
I've seen it somewhere.
That's interesting. Meaningless. Oh. This is actually just a whole bunch of stuff rammed together as no meaning.
You probably could have guessed semicolons.
This actually means nothing. Okay? But did you guys notice the reaction that you got out of it? Like we had eyes bulging out of your head, and as we got kind of higher in the level, you guys started to get a little bit scared, no? Did I scare anyone? Anyone? Now, where do you think people on the street start to get scared? I would say right by quantum mechanics.
Like, as soon as you bring math, then they're shy.
Well, I think they can understand multiplication, though, right? Yeah. So things like EMC squared and FMA are still accessible.
So calculus.
For my student, they think about Greek letters too, because as soon as they see a symbol that they don't recognize,
yeah.
What the heck is that?
Yeah, so it's a little harder to attach. Also,
even in FF equals mu FG, they don't know.
Yeah, it's true.
They can't,
also, though, we're starting to talk about concepts that are more abstract, less tangible. Mm-hmm. And that also starts to scare people because you got to use your brain a little bit more, right? The reactions that I got out of you guys were a great audience for this. I got a lot of reaction, right? Now, when you tell people on the street that you're interested in physics, or if you meet a friend or someone your own age, and you tell them you're interested in physics, do you guys usually get a reaction? Anyone?
No.
I have had so many reactions when you start telling you study physics. And the reactions you get are just mind-boggling a lot of the time. I find myself standing there going, where do you guys get these ideas? Like, how is that your image of physics? And so what I want to talk about for a second, I'm going to go through some thank you, Google Images. There are a lot of really funny reactions, and you get people making faces like that. So what I want to walk you guys through, I found, though, that there are only, in my experience, a finite number of reactions, and they start to kind of quickly be classified. So what I want to do is I'm going to walk through the major reactions that I get when I tell people that I study physics. And I want to see if you guys can come up with a good way to respond to a lot of these, because some of them are actually to the point of being downright offensive. Okay? So we're going to start off with some fun ones. You must be a genius.
Thank you.
Or they say something.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's one way of looking at it. This is an interesting one for me. People seem to associate physics and genius, or really, really intelligent. You know, it's so funny. But what's interesting is you also hear you've got literary geniuses like Shakespeare, got the artistic like Van Gogh, or musical like Mozart. So we have geniuses in all different sorts of areas of study or art. But there is one name that above all is synonymous with genius. And of course, Einstein, right? You hear people kind of saying, you know, way to go, Einstein, like, you know, you must be a genius. It's true, his name is what ties it, right? So what does it mean to be a genius? Do you guys have any ideas? What is a genius?
To change?
Beyond what?
Beyond the general.
Thinking outside the box.
Yeah, beyond general intelligence?
Beyond norm.
Not beyond norm? Well, there's someone else over
here. The thing that puts Einstein above the rest is that he changed the entire world. Just one little idea.
Okay, but what about people? We've got like Newton, Nash, Feynman. You've got Penrose, Hawking. Just the list goes on of the different kind of geniuses that you've got in physics.
Right? But then again, he's one of those
people. Yeah, it's
still not. People kind of. Feynman's
really recent.
Yeah. Hawking. Mm-hmm.
Einstein just.
Is it the hair?
Yeah.
Is it the image?
Yeah.
But let's look beyond Einstein, though, as to just the whole group of geniuses that we can take a look at. What is the consistent? What are the consistent traits? What make them geniuses?
Well, genius is just a perception, and the perception of genius is basically that you know that you know something that they don't.
So you're saying there's no such real thing as genius? I mean, he didn't possess anything.
Well, he had talent, but if you call him a genius, because that's a special class of person.
Shaw thought that a genius was someone who could assess situations in a different way from someone else.
Okay, so seeing things differently.
Yeah.
That's one perspective on what I think genius is. Could it just be a combination of curiosity and hard work, though? I don't think it could be. Yeah. I think a lot of people are curious and have like, they've been seeing some other things. So is there an element of
luck
then?
There's an element of natural form.
Yeah, natural
talent. Okay. So do you guys figure it's a combination of all those things?
Yeah.
You know what, I've given this question quite a bit of thought, and I personally haven't come up with a conclusion. I flux from day to day as to what I think the components are.
Have a different opinion.
Yeah. And I think in different situations, it's probably different parts of it that come out. It probably is a collection of hard work, curiosity, personality, talent. You probably have a whole collection of things that are contributing. Okay?
You could even have different kinds of geniuses. So that one.
Yeah, like literary, artistic.
Well, no, you could have one that's seen as a genius because they are hardworking and.
Yeah.
And they persist throughout all the things, and they're curious, and they end up knowing something.
Absolutely. Having a breakthrough. But here's where the follow-up question to that comes: do you have to be a genius to be in physics?
No.
Wow, that was very resentful. No. Why?
Because we're not.
Amen.
Some people call you a genius. Right? This is what I mean, this is the reaction you get. I have people turning at me, kind of going, oh,
if that's what you want to do with it, if you want to like discover something, then obviously you have to be a little bit better than anyone else in physics. But if you just want to do it to understand the mechanics of how things work.
Do you think you have to have the intelligence for it, though, too? Not necessarily. I think it's more passion and love for it. No, there is a certain sort of prerequisite intelligence.
Like, if you're one of these people with a mental block for math, there's no possible way you'll be able to go anywhere.
Okay,
let's say that you're well in
physics. I'm trying to be the best at math. He had incredible imagination. Like he was at it. Like he was, you know.
He had someone teach him differential geometry, right?
Yeah, he was like.
Well, I think everyone has someone teach them something.
But he used Petty Insight to kind of combine it, right?
He couldn't, like, he didn't do all the math for his own equation, for his own theories. He had
That's what mathematicians are for.
But then you look at someone like Beethoven, who was also considered a genius, and he did come up with calculus. Now, it's not the argument who came up with it first, but he was one of the founders of calculus, right? So he did create math. Do you think that? So I guess you can say that intelligence is important, and you guys also said curiosity is probably important, right? The other ones that I kind of list off, passion, hard work, tenacity, confidence, and I think there's an element of luck.
Yeah.
That can be agreed on? So now we have this kind of image, now we kind of made our own picture of a genius that may have something to do with Einstein, but it isn't the hair and the whole look, right? So now how do you respond when someone says something like, you know, well, you must be really, really brilliant to be in that, or you must be absolutely a genius? How do you respond?
Thanks. You can't keep yourself delusion.
Sorry?
Keep yourself delusion.
You think people can just keep their delusions and it doesn't matter if anyone else cares about physics?
No, it works for our advantage rather than thinking we're a genius.
Why? What about when it comes time to get funding? If they don't understand it, why are they going to be there?
90% of people don't understand the taxation system.
A real genius will
be able to
get on
pants. Don't get thrown in jail if that contributes to physics,
right? I think it's a certain level of scholarship that just sort of conveys a sense of trust.
Yeah.
So if you have confidence in what you're talking about and what you've studied, then other people will have confidence in you.
So you think you need to just keep on going, oh yeah, I'm a total genius.
Well, not that. You need to be able to actually back up what you say, you know. Yeah. You need to be able to say, present your ideas in such a way that people can understand them and believe.
So,
but I'm saying, what's your direct response, though? I mean, keep that in mind, that's a good idea. What's your direct response when someone says, man, you must be a genius?
No, I'm just work hard.
Work hard? That's one way of saying it. What else? Just curious? Mm-hmm. I love what I'm doing? What about something like that? And that way you're not pushing ahead this image of I've got to have frizzy, crazy hair and I've got to be like this crazy genius, you know what I mean? It's just kind of a subtle thing. But what I try and always do is just... I don't work hard either, but I like to tell people I love what I'm doing. Right? So it's just, if you want to maybe pick your aspects that we were talking about, that's important to you, if curiosity is more important or hard work. It's just something to think about. Okay? Next reaction, now, this is a fun one. You're too hippie. No, I actually, this guy was hitting on me relentlessly. And he kept, and, you know, so I'm just kind of, you know, to find some home, you know, what are you studying? You know, this guy was just classic, guilty. and so I just kind of, mathematical physics. And you can just see him start to gape, going, you're too cute to be a nerd, and it's just this kind of quick defensiveness, and that ended that quickly. But yeah, I actually had someone say this. Now, before we go into this, I want to start talking about how I'm going to use the word geek and the word nerd. Now, I know everyone has their own way of using them. I'm going to just, let's talk about how I'm going to use them for the purpose of this little segment. Geek or nerd?
Geek.
One person's thinking of the reason for that.
I'd say that a geek doesn't have to be particularly intelligent.
Yeah.
Okay, a geek, not intelligent.
I would actually take the opposite definition that a geek would be somebody who is intelligent and possesses a certain amount of knowledge in a particular field, whereas a nerd would be just somebody who's socially inept.
I have to take the total opposite, just going by the etymology, because a geek originally comes from a circus freak who likes to have chickens.
I'm really impressed someone knew that. Okay. So let's go. How many for geek? I'm not going to count, I'm going to go roughly. How many for nerd? Okay, so geek. Actually, that is how I'm going to use it. I take the idea that he obsessively, it's comic book guy, right? So obsessive information mongering, really after things like comic books and Star Trek and, yeah, this is kind of his, he knows way too much about comic books. Lisa Simpson, geek or nerd?
Nerd.
Wow, okay, why?
Well,
She's smart. she had that same kind of like the geek that comes from Greg a little bit, kind of patronized by the other characters. She's ostracized, right? Mm-hmm. Is she?
Yeah.
Yeah, but why?
Because she knows she's
smart. Yeah. That's all. But when you say she's smart, what does she know a lot about? Like, I mean, comic book guy knows a lot about comic stuff. Academic stuff. Yeah.
Useful
stuff.
More useful.
So we're saying useful, like science.
She
I'm sorry.
She knows a lot about everything, like sciences, music, and not comics.
Sure.
She's intelligent and wise.
Yeah. Okay. That's
but
true.
Not very many friends.
But not very many friends. Yeah. Good point. So yeah, that's I did classify Lisa Simpson as a nerd as well. Professor Frank. I want to ask you for it.
He's a bonus.
Oh, why?
Because he's like. He's a mixture between the comic book guy where he obsesses on one thing and Lisa just.
Yeah.
He's always really smart, but he's also, you know, maybe being sort of socially inept.
He doesn't do small part of practical things, like...
Yeah, we need that topper thing to the kindergarten.
We invented a device that could see into the future.
What'd you say?
We invented a device that could see into the future.
Practical. Yeah, but he also
does practice a little bit of earmarks.
Okay.
So yeah, Frank was definitely both. I kind of classified him as both, having the aspects of both the geek and the nerd. So that's how I'm going to use those two terms. You guys have an idea of how I'm going to use them now?
Yeah.
Okay. Just so it's clear, I do consider. Oh shoot. Sorry. Yeah.
Just breathe.
Okay. Sorry about that. So I do consider myself a nerd. I've heard it, in fact. So I consider myself a nerd because I have an interest in physics. I love studying math. I also have an interest in classical music. So I know a fair bit about that kind of field too. And I'm always up for a good argument about philosophy. So I do consider myself a nerd in that sense. I like to consider myself at least halfway intelligent. I do have geeky tendencies as well, of course. Well, I wear glasses. And I have a big obsession with the Matrix. I'm like still people on Trinity. But the fact of the matter was, I wasn't really exposed to any nerd culture, or sorry, geek culture, until I hit university. All through elementary school and high school, I was spending all my time figure skating. And dancing. I did a lot of dance and stuff like that. I didn't really know. I hadn't even seen Star Wars until this year. Any of them. Okay, none of them. So when I hit physics in university, though, I found it shocking because for all that I expect a level of nerdiness, because by my definition, just having that intense interest in physics would make me a nerd. I didn't expect the geekiness that I found. And I was shocked and almost taken back by it. There are stereotypes like you wouldn't believe. I met a guy who honestly wears his pants up here, and they'd be like purple sweatpants with elastic bands around here. I mean, they're just completely clueless, too. And so you see these stereotypes kind of walking around, and I was so shocked that these stereotypes existed. And things like magic cards, Warhammer, Dungeons and Dragons, games that I didn't know existed, are standard fare. And what I noticed that probably shocked me the most was the backlash against people that didn't necessarily appear geeky. If you said you had interest in something like dance or figure skating, it was kind of a cheating in physics, you know? And there was a bit of a backlash. But what I've found is it's not in the way, when I first noticed it, it shocked me and I expected it to be a certain way and I expected to also be around these stereotypes and be this total outcast. But what I found is it's also not the way I expected to swing that way. The culture that's there was nothing like I expected. The thing about the program at Waterloo, anyway, I know it's a really small program. There aren't many of us. And it's a demanding program. Heavy course load, all this kind of stuff. So you end up having to work together to do it. And so it starts, when you're in a small class anyway, what you find is that whether you're a junior nerd, no one cares. They want to get the assignment done. So that starts to fall out of the way. People stop to worry about that. The ideas of cool and geeky and all this kind of stuff that you get in high school aren't there. You're in university, and it just tends to disappear. And this is why I think some of the geekier attributes may come out. It's because no one cares anymore. It's not that you're necessarily geeky, or that you're cool, or that you're, you know, athletic. The problem is all the lines just start to melt. And so it's not a problem. It's just, bad miswording. It was shocked, okay? And so what you start to find is just that everyone has all these shades, and that while in the program, while they're all together, you may see a lot of these geeky attributes. You may not realize that person also plays sports and does this kind of thing. So when people make comments like, you know, you must be a nerd and stuff, how do you respond to that? How would you respond kind of with that culture in mind?
Yeah,
you do all
the
stuff
all
in physics.
Yeah,
you
have to
have physics. You don't have a lot.
Yeah. You always end up working for that.
Sure. What other responses would you guys give? Anything?
Thank you. There is rule of the world.
So there's a bit of a pride in there?
Yeah.
And you know what? That is what I've found develops. Out of everything, it's probably a few years ago, I wouldn't call myself a nerd just because.
I'm pretty sure.
Now I'm proudly carrying on. Yeah. So what I tend to do is just laugh. I don't feel that I'm the stereotype of a nerd, so you kind of laugh and walk away. It's such a silly idea that I just don't pay much attention to it. Now, this one we had already saw come up. Take a look at a really cool picture. It's from the Solvay Conference 1927. The big names, if you can see them, all across the lot. But just take a look. How many females can you see in this picture? There's one. That I'm curious. Yeah, exactly. Now, I'm going to apologize right off. This is when I said that there were some topics and reactions that I get that I find more offensive. This would be the one that I'm talking about. And I'm going to apologize right off if I sound somewhat emotionally convicted talking about this. I knew that there was a gap in the numbers. I mean, it's not too bad here. You guys have a pretty good ratio. But there is a huge gap in the numbers, without a doubt. But I didn't expect the attitudes. I mean, I told one guy that I, you know, studying physics. And he just pauses for a second and goes, okay. You have a problem with girls these days? They spend too much time reading and not enough having babies. And I also had comments like, I'm not sexist, I just don't think girls naturally like physics. Just like guys naturally like football and not shopping.
I like shopping.
I guess I've just been continually shocked and disappointed at just how widespread and pervasive this image is. That girls can't do physics, shouldn't do physics, wouldn't want to do physics. I am very young, but I think I knew by about grade 4, I had this whole image that girls weren't supposed to like math and it was supposed to be hard. Luckily I had a teacher who snapped me out of that one. But it scares me just how much I've seen this come up. I've kind of seen it in a few groups. There's sort of a small group of the old boys who just don't want to see women in physics. And that's a really small group, kind of not really the big problem. There are some that I found in my classes who are blatantly sexist and will just come out with things like women are people, statements that, yeah, they shock me, but you know what, I've time and time again you hear them. But the biggest group, and to me it's the biggest problem, are those that just hold underlying assumptions. They just assume that women aren't interested, or they assume they can't do it. And they're very happy to have a woman in the program, but they just kind of assume they're not going to make it. And it's these assumptions that are dangerous, because they're the hardest to counter. If someone comes out with a blatantly sexist remark, there's some taboo surrounding, there's some sort of yee factor to it. But if it's just an assumption, if it's subtle, there's no counterfactor, you can't kind of smack it. You can't get back at it hard. And it's also it's more difficult to spot. I've discovered people that I thought were really, really close friends, and they came out with statements that shocked me. Why is it this way?
Okay, like for me personally, since I go to an all-girls school, like I see this kind of stereotype almost every single day. They won't have advanced courses in sciences. They only have them in humanities. And you know, like people say that they're going to do things to try to balance the ratio. They want to change this sort of situation, but you know, I don't see it in my life. And I think a lot has to do with also cultural expectations and what your family wants. And you know, like certain cultures, like from where I'm from, sciences is not exactly something that you know should be involved with.
I think even in North American society, we kind of have this image of the what girls should do.
Yeah.
Kind of the Britney Spears.
Historical inertia.
Yeah.
Well, I moved to school to get away from it. Like, if I was in school, yeah. You weren't allowed to take, like, the national test. You weren't allowed to play chess. You weren't allowed to do, like, anything. There was girls' things and there was guys' things. So that's why I go to all girls.
Wow.
There's, like, we have heaps of people doing physics. Whereas mom, like, when she was one of her whole grade girls
who did physics. How many of them, sir?
Well, in our school, kind of the opposite. Like, 3/4 of all the advanced classes are girls.
Really?
Yeah.
Have any of the guys seen any of the problems with it, or is it just?
In our school, my physics class last year had one girl in it.
Yeah.
Like just one, and there was one person came in afterwards. But I think part of that was the way the course was taught, and that it might just be the way that the girls in my school tend to learn. There's a few of them that have different learning styles.
There has been some talk about learning styles as well, yeah.
But there's a lot of language in a lot of the girls that I know are either language-based or idea-based, and just writing down a bunch of math equations.
Yeah.
It wasn't taught like, this is what these math equations actually mean.
Yeah, part of that plug-and-play stuff, I know he really feels like, here's an equation, it's all just math.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't really physics, right?
I know a girl who got 99 in grade 11 physics and did not know an ounce of physics because
yeah.
It had been taught entirely plug and play.
Yeah, exactly. Does anyone here think it's just a biological?
I think there's a little bit to that, but
like,
I mean,
that's a person.
Yeah,
you think differently, but
you think that women are biological, not just. No. I think it's a thank you. Yeah, I think women approach the subject material from the perspective of men, the classical approach to teaching physics focuses more on the male attitude.
It's not only that, I think it portrays it as
a girl. We haven't had
any girls in. Yeah, so that kind of leads right into what I want to talk about next. Does it need to be changed, and why?
If you have two different types of brains thinking, it's going to be better than just one.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be worse.
Let's
get the dolphins in on it then.
I think it's like a total societal thing. Like, I don't think you're going to change it by just, you know, encouraging universities to drop the standard for girls to get in, or like, I've heard of in engineering at Queen's, they no longer require geometry and just math or like algebra or whatever.
Yeah, they make it easier, they give financial.
And supposedly the reasoning behind that is
there's fewer girls that take that class, so it'll be
older. Yeah, I believe in that.
No, so I don't think that's what I'm going to
do. You should be given the opportunity to learn. It shouldn't be like a...
Yeah.
We shouldn't be just lowering our
standards. Yeah, so I'm supposed to get into university knowing if they lowered it, you can get it.
Yeah.
Like that. But what about, what can you guys do to change it? Okay, first of all, why do we need to change it? I'm going to give you my reasoning for it. Okay, can you guys listen, please? Can you guys listen up? Thanks. My reasoning for why I think it needs to be changed is if we look at the big advancements in physics, it comes from a different perspective. Each time someone saw how to see things differently. And the same reason we want to work in an international community, you get different philosophical backgrounds just by how you're brought up in a different culture. That can add to those very perspectives that we can work with. If you bring in a stronger feminine presence, I just think you have a different way of thinking of things.
Yeah, definitely.
Or possibly. It may not make a difference, but it's worth a shot, right?
Yeah.
That's where I come from on it. But what can you guys do to change it? What do you think you can? I don't want to make this too much of like a rah-rah. But I do want
a lot of you have to help girls. There's a lot of girls that I talk to in my school or whatever. It's not that they're not good at physics or they don't want to go into math or anything. It's that media portrays it as you shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
And so they're almost afraid to go in because the guys won't like them because they're nerds or whatever. They're not cool enough.
Yeah.
I think the only way that the public opinion will change is if there's more girls to do it. You know, every time a guy has to say, you're going to be a physics career girl.
But what can you guys each individually do?
Not
like you're talking about it. No? I disagree. Get people interested. Like, that's what I do at my school. I'm in charge of my whole school getting people interested. And I go to an old girls' school. That's what a university pays me to do that.
Yeah.
Just to get them interested. It's not to make them do physics, it's to just get them interested and curious about that.
Exactly.
And that isn't that what this program is about.
Exactly. Exactly. This is part of Perimeter's outreach, right?
That's how you do it.
And I also just think that each time you come up to someone who expresses an opinion, and I try and do it kind of one person at a time, each time someone comes up against something like that, I talk to them about it, trying to figure out. I mentioned before that one of my friends, I discovered he held some scary underlying assumptions. His assumption was that it is a biological reason that women do not like physics. He assumed that even with changing the way it's taught, even the way society views it, that if you change it, you can still only get at most 20% women, like, out of the whole total in physics, about 20%. But actually, I talked him through it, and we talked for, oh god, hours. And I'm just going to read you a few things. We were talking MSN, so I have some of the, I'm going to just read off what he said to me, because he did come around, and he did kind of see a different way of looking at it. This is what he told me. I have always said that we should make things fair for everyone. I understand now that subconsciously a thought, such as the one I had, may cause us to do things that we are unaware of, such as not make things fair for everyone. Regardless of whether I am right or wrong, I still shouldn't let it influence my decision at all. I shouldn't even consider it a possibility. So in other words, I gotta watch what I think, not only what I say. And I think that pretty much sums up the conclusions I wanted him to come around to, and I was really, really impressed that he was willing to change like that. It was really incredible. So how do you respond? I know the girls are going to come up against probably more than the guys, but the guys still have to make an effort. I would like to still have guys making an effort to change this too. So how do you respond when you see gaps like that?
Well, I always am trying to get my friends interested, whether they're girls or guys. And, and I know that I have come across some resistance from both of them, but it's really, like, sometimes there's people who don't even know that they're going to be interested in physics, and you can just get them interested in it. And
they have exposure to it.
Yeah, and once you've exposed them to it, then they really tend to pick it up, whether they're a girl or not. So
I believe if you encourage them and not just like bring them down, like then the natural curiosity will come because like we're all born with the natural curiosity like around us.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, like you don't see like a baby walk around and just own in a corner and just being there all day. So like I believe if you just encourage like
that people are going to have to, and like
encourage the natural
and,
curiosity.
Yeah, and don't like bring down with like prepositions like that girls can't be.
Yeah.
So, there's, and, like,
that's so what you have something you said?
Well, I just sort of, I encourage them sort of like I encourage everyone else. Like, my best friends are all girls, so I'll be up working on a physics problem and say, oh, this is really cool, and they might, and I'll explain it, and they might say, oh, that's really cool or something.
So what you guys are generally saying is just let your own enthusiasm come through.
Yeah, and try to start with everyone around you.
Try to explain to them that and if media is, in a sense, wrong. Like, I try to explain to them that beauty and learning should go together. It can't just be beauty in one area and brains in another.
Yeah. Just be enthusiastic about people fall. Isn't that why we're all here? Like, we're all enthusiastic.
Being enthusiastic, interested.
If you're enthusiastic, don't scare people about it. Just, you know,
yeah.
Say, oh, you know, I have this really good physics lesson, blah, 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 blah. Make it, like, simple for them to understand, but make it curious. Like,
and when I've had people say things like, but you're a girl, or there can't be many girls in that, and things like that, I just kind of, you know what, I'm interested in it, and I seem to have talent for it. And that's just kind of the bottom line I like to lay out for them. Because that's all I can really tell them is the situation for myself. So, I gotta keep moving here so we can get to lunch, so you guys have a lot to say. Is that like engineering or bad math? Does anyone recognize this picture, by the way?
Yeah.
That's okay.
Physics is not just math or just engineering. It's not like engineering. It's its own subject. It's very distinct. Who knows the difference?
What do they mean by bad math?
Yeah. I have no idea.
Bad.
They think it's just kind of...
Oh, yeah.
They think it's just like, it's not as in-depth math, I think is what they're getting at.
Oh,
I had someone say this to me, so I don't really know what
they
mean.
They might mean bad as in big, scary, rapid equations devour your soul, like, super bad.
Physics would be like the study of how the world works, where engineering is taking what you do in physics and applying it for useful applications.
And math is useless.
Physics is the whys and engineering is the hows.
Yeah. What about math and physics? What's the difference there?
Well, math is useless.
Math is
useless.
That is pure unlike math. A mathematician goes in with not only not caring whether they do something useful, not wanting to do anything useful.
Okay, so I think like engineering, as Anjuna said, is you know, developing new technologies and applying things. But in order to have breakthroughs in engineering, you have to have breakthroughs in physics. And sometimes in order to have breakthroughs in physics, you have to have breakthroughs in math.
Yeah.
Like the level above.
Okay, so this is how I'm, sorry, gotta keep this moving. This is how I'm gonna kind of see it. Physics is seeking an understanding and a pattern in the fundamental nature of the universe. Engineering is just looking at applications of physics. They don't care about the fundamental nature so long as it works. And math deals in ideas and concepts and doesn't really pay attention to reality. They're just dealing kind of in a very abstract world. But it is a language that physics uses and needs to use. But I think there are other languages that are required in physics. I don't think it can just be math. We do need words as well, conceptual descriptions, pictures, and you get things like diagrams, like the Feynman diagrams, which would be showing how particles interact and that sort of thing. So when I get this reaction, I just start to explain the differences to them. People just seem to blur them all into kind of one big lump. And they're not. Really, not at all. So I just try to explain that one. Physics was the only course I nearly failed in high school. There is a very esoteric image of physics. This kind of ties back to what I was talking about with the geniuses. It's this image of physics kind of just being out there and untouchable. The same way you guys had that reaction with the equations, it's just kind of like, oh my goodness, what is that? And it's scary. And people put it out there. It tends to use math that they don't understand. And a lot of times the foundations of math aren't taught properly all the way through school, or taught very strongly. So math is very scary to a lot of people. And it deals with abstract concepts. So this also contributes to that esoteric image. I think another big problem is probably the way people are exposed to physics. A lot of times first exposure is in high school, and without a doubt there's a problem with the way it's shown. Like we were talking before about kind of the, here's an equation, plug in the numbers, here's an equation, plug in the numbers. And that's not physics, right? We're just dealing with kind of memorizing and putting things in without understanding anything. And I think that deals, that's a big part of why people wouldn't like it if what they're studying as physics isn't really what physics is. I mean, is that really why any of you guys are here? It's like, ooh, here, look, I can plug in numbers to FMA. Like, that's not really why you guys are interested, I hope.
No.
Sorry?
But I don't even like physics at school.
Yeah.
It's like, ugh.
I really, really hated high school physics until I was really lucky in having incredibly great teachers. He had a solid teacher, and he took me aside, handed me a book on kind of the ideas and theories with interpretations of quantum mechanics, and that's what got me interested. I had no interest in it before that.
Did you say what book was it?
In Search of Schrodinger's Cat by John Grimmon.
Oh, yeah.
It's a good one. I enjoyed it. So, how do you respond to that?
Okay. Say what we just said, like, high school isn't what, like, physics is crap.
Yeah, it's just like the
story of that. I don't
see why you always have to jump into the best. Yeah, you really want to look into these physics systems. You want to have to deal with these reactions.
Say high school is physics.
It's not for everyone. That's the fact of the matter. Like,
I don't
feel the need to convince everyone that physics is the same thing.
Not everyone, but you need to kind of keep perpetuating this image that it's really, really esoteric and hard.
Well,
it is hard.
The last 25 years is always more interesting.
We don't need to get the entire world to realize it's something really easy.
There are plenty of questions.
It is kind of nice having it be a smaller group.
You guys like it.
My sort of one-liner is that about, well, a lot of the time that's just the way it's taught, that they don't teach ideas, they just teach equations.
Yeah, so that's generally the way I'll go about it. It's just kind of, well, you must have, I mean, maybe you had a bad experience, and I generally like to tell them, well, you know, there is interesting stuff out there. I find myself recommending books to people to read just to see if they'll get interested in it. It's always, I just like to try it. I know some of you guys want to keep it esoteric. I personally, I mean, I love it, so I don't see why everyone else shouldn't love it. I guess that's my attitude about it.
Maybe we should always do an English right now, because in school they teach us how to write an essay, they don't teach us the beauty behind the literature. Maybe we should all be doing that. It's the same thing, everybody has it.
Yeah, but you know what, the thing is there's a lot small, there's a really small group though that gets interested in physics. And the thing is, you will see,
everyone has English.
People don't say that.
Yeah, that was the only approach I used to take in high school. They say, you know, physics.
Are you just trying to say esoteric kind of?
Well, yeah.
I don't know. I think it's kind of interesting how like during Einstein's time when everyone was all like the public was all excited about physics, or even during the 60s when the space race was, or like when the landed on the moon and everyone was all excited about it. I think that's pretty cool. Like when the public gets so interested in science, whereas now it's like, you know, it'll be really
embarrassed. Yeah, nothing's happening. Like,
yeah, and no money spent on it and.
No money.
Well,
so there's a solution. Yeah, just have to trap 40 years ago.
There you go.
Yeah.
You guys know what everyone else is saying, please? Okay, we're going to keep it moving. What are you going to do with that? This is a reaction I get a lot.
Well, that's what you did for an arts major.
Yeah, I did say that, didn't I? People can't see an instant payoff in this one, like the way they can with engineering and math. And like we've already talked about, they tend to group those together. So kind of think, well, if you're good with that, why do you go into engineering? Why do you go into math? Engineering, you come out, you can be a professional kind of right away. Math, you can do things like accounting, actuarial science. stuff like that, but you can actually go straight into, there's a lot more money there, essentially. My parents like to always tell me that I'm just going to become a professional student, which that's my problem. They just don't want to be funding me forever. So what can you do with a physics degree? Anyone? Okay, well, I'm going to go through the stuff I have. I'm going to need to research last. That's what I want to talk about a little bit more. You've got business is actually, in business fields, they're really after physics minds right now because of the problem-solving abilities and the ability to see relations and systems, things like that. It's really helpful in business communities now. You can be a teacher or a professor. You can go into engineering. It is a possibility, right? Space programs, get involved at NASA, is the big one, right?
Big Burt Rutten for a job.
Sorry?
Big Burt Rutten for a job.
What? Who's that?
Burt Rutten. Scout Thompson's only man currently who can fly in space on his own.
Oh.
The X-Prize.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Computer science jobs are also available. Sorry, I've got two moving because I'm running over time. You can also do things in medical technology. Again, that's a field where there's more money, in case that's something you're worried about. And the thing is, no, there are people who really are looking to make money.
Just get there and then have to work part-time.
Yeah, no, I'm just, I mean, everyone likes some money, right? The other thing is I've even had a lot of people suggest that, you know, doing things after physics degree, you can do a law degree for all, there are just a lot of opportunities open to you after doing a physics degree in university. I've been told a million times to go to patent law and things like this. And of course there's research. Within research, you've got experimental or practical and theoretical research, right? You guys have a general picture of what those both are. Let's see. That, of course, is a difficult route. No one's getting a PhD is easy. And I'm not going to give you kind of a, when people believe in yourself, you can definitely do it and all this kind of stuff, because it's not really my style. That's something you really have to decide that you want. And I guess what's important if you're going to pick one of these is to just look at what your strong points are. Research isn't for everyone, engineering isn't for everyone. You have to look at what your skills are. I know that if I tried to do anything practical, I'd probably explode because I'm just really not good in labs or anything hands-on. Look at my lab chair sitting back here. You can probably definitely say I'm not so good in kind of laboratories that I just inept. But I'm better if I can do things with theory. So that's, for me, right now, where I'm heading. But when people kind of ask me this, I don't like to commit to anything. I think that I'm 20 years old and I've still got a lot of time for me to decide where I want to go. And I'm almost a little resentful of them telling me I have to decide what I'm going to do with it right now. And so I tend to just be really vague about it.
Which doesn't actually help dispel it.
Dispel what?
That you can't do anything with it.
No, I say my plan right now is that I would like to get a PhD. That is my plan right now. But that there are plenty of other things that I'm considering.
But you don't have your entire future plan out.
I guess what my problem is I don't like this focus on what are you going to do with it all the time. I want to know why I'm doing it. I want to know. It's more, from my perspective anyway, this is just my own personal opinion, I think it's more important to know why you're going to do something at this age than it is exactly what you're going to do. Because I figure I can make things work out somehow if I know why I'm doing it, if I know what my drive is. And this is what I mean about knowing your talents, knowing yourself. This might sound a little preachy, but this is how I put it. And this is just, it's something very important to me to know why I'm doing it. And I'm not saying don't consider. Don't kind of wake up one day and say, at some point I gotta get a job, don't I? Like, no, I've looked at all these different possibilities and I'm always considering them all. But I'm not deciding right now. I'm far too young for that, and so are you guys. That's kind of my two cents on that one. Just that I like to do that. And the last one is genuine interest. And I get a lot of times people are going, I heard about string theory. What what's that? And I'd give things like, well, is time travel possible? This is to me the most difficult one to respond to, because you have to know your stuff. You have to know how to put it in simple terms still, but accurately. And I think we have a responsibility. Personally, I think we all have a responsibility to give a good answer to this one. You guys kind of hinted at this all the way through. Why do we need people interested in physics? Why bother? Why do they give you genuine interest? Do you have to, in my opinion anyway, why do you have that responsibility to give them a good, accurate answer?
Keep it going.
Yeah.
Keep what going?
Does anyone have something else?
So people will pay for physicists.
There we go. Anything else?
Well, you just want to be nice.
You want to be nice. one of the big ones is going to be funding.
It's science. You know, it's supposed to be the correct
answers.
Yeah, really.
But not incorrect answers, but you want to kind of give them some more than just kind of saying yes. But is time travel possible? No.
Why?
Maybe. Yeah, like you want to do more than that, right? And why do I think you have that responsibility? I think funding, first of all, you want to if you don't have an excitement in the general public, it's hard to get funding, right? You need people who have money to give you money. Simple as that. I also think it allows for a greater personal understanding of the concept. Yeah. It also allows for a greater personal understanding because you can. When you explain to someone in simple terms, you clarify your own understanding of it. But I think the most important reason is that if we can get more people interested in physics and get them more accurately interested in physics without kind of the misconceptions about nerds and girls and failing and all that kind of stuff, that the more interest you get, you kind of remove that ignorance. And slowly you kind of remove that fear when they look at those equations. And when you remove that fear, you remove that esoteric thing, you actually will eventually get rid of all those other reactions. And that the only one you have is genuine interest.
If you popularize physics, a lot of the really bright minds who are attracted to physics go to it because they're disinclined towards popular themes. If you popularize physics, they're not going to go there. They're going to run out of genius types.
Yeah, but what about the, okay, if you say, like, I want to include people, because if you say there's someone out there that's, like, the next Einstein, and you're like, he doesn't know about it, you don't tell him, you're not going to get further in physics.
Well, that can do something somewhere else, though, right?
And that's kind of the end of what I wanted to talk about. I personally think that it'll actually be the best for physics. So that's kind of what I want to talk about. Okay? So now we're going to go eat.
How was that style?